So far in the course, we've looked at ordinary differential equations. Those are differential equations that involve a single variable. Now we're going to start our study of partial differential equations. And I'm going to show you a technique called the separation of variables. I should warn you, this doesn't work all the time, but it works often enough that it is an extremely useful technique for solving partial differential equations. And all of these equations are going to involve an operator that we met last time, this differential operator, the Laplacian. So to remind you, the Laplacian is the divergence of the gradient, and it acts on one scalar function, for example, t of r, and returns to you a different scalar function, s of r. So that same operator is written here, and this partial differential equation involving the Laplacian is called Laplace's equation. This scalar function phi of r, for example, could be the voltage. And it's a scalar function because you would tell me three numbers. So here it is written in coordinate free form. But if you were using Cartesian coordinates, you would pick an x, a y, and a z. Tell me those three numbers. And then the function would return the voltage at that particular point in space. You could also use a different coordinate system. You could use spherical polar coordinates, r, theta, and phi. And again, tell me those three numbers, and I will tell you the voltage of that location in space. So Laplace's equation says that the Laplacian of this scalar function of position is equal to zero. For practice, let's characterize it. The order is second because of the two space derivatives. Just to remind you what the Laplacian is, here it is written in Cartesian coordinates, and you can see second derivative with respect to x, second derivative with respect to y, second derivative with respect to z. So the highest order derivative is 2, no matter which term you're looking at. This equation is linear in the function. The function is phi. The variables are x, y, and z. So it's linear in the function phi. It's also homogeneous because every term, there's only one term. That term involves phi. There are no terms that don't involve phi. If there were something like the number 7 on the right-hand side, that would be a non-homogeneous term. But this equation is homogeneous, and it is your first example in this course of a partial differential equation, or PDE. Down below, on the bottom of the page, there's the non-homogeneous version of the same equation. So the same operator, Laplacian, acting on the voltage function. And now, on the right-hand side, there is a different scalar function. On the top, the scalar function 0 is maybe the easiest scalar function you can imagine, and that makes the equation homogeneous. In the non-homogeneous version, there is a term that does not involve phi, but it is, it's not a constant like 7 in my example. It's another function. And this, from electrostatics, this is the charge density. Rho of r is another scalar function called the charge density. So minus rho of r divided by this MKS constant epsilon naught makes the non-homogeneous version of Laplace's equation, and this has its own name. This is called Poisson's equation. Okay, the technique separation of variables involves making an ansatz. This is a German noun, that's why it's capitalized. And ansatz would translate as approach or sometimes guess. And so I'll make a guess or a hypothesis that the voltage function, let's say I'm using Cartesian coordinates x, y, z, the voltage function would be factorized. So that means it is some function f of x, like x squared plus 2x, times some function of y, like sine of y times the square root of y, times some function h of z, e to the z, for example. And if you can write the solution in that form, a function of x times a function of y times a function of z, then that form is called factorized. Now, this is what doesn't always work. It is not always possible to write the solution in separable form. For example, if the solution is 1 over r squared in Cartesian coordinates, that's 1 over x squared plus y squared plus z squared, that cannot be written as some function of x times some function of y times some function of z. The coordinates are just so intricately mixed with each other here, it's not possible to factorize them. Here's an even simpler example. X plus Y cannot be written in the form function of X times function of Y times function of Z. So if the solution is one of these two forms or any of the other infinitely many that cannot be factorized, this technique, separation of variables, won't work. You'll have to try something else. If instead of using Cartesian coordinates, X, Y, and Z, you were inclined to use spherical polar coordinates, R, theta, and phi, then the factorized form would look like this. There would be some function of the radial coordinate R times some other function of the polar angle theta times a third function of the azimuthal angle phi, and then multiplied together. Again, not every solution looks like that. But enough of them do, so that this technique is handy. You should have it in your toolkit. Here is another equation besides Laplace's equation and Poisson's equation. This is the Schrodinger equation, the non-relativistic spin zero equation from quantum mechanics, minus Planck's reduced constant h bar squared over twice the mass of the particle. And then you see the Laplacian coming in again. And the Laplacian acts on the wave function psi of r and t. This time, the wave function depends on the three spatial coordinates, but then also the time. And the middle term is the potential, which can, in principle, depend on both space and time, multiplied by the wave function again. And then on the right-hand side, I times Planck's reduced constant times the time derivative, partial with respect to t, of the wave function psi of r and t. And again, just for practice, let's characterize it. This is second order. Even though this is one derivative with respect to time, these are two derivatives with respect to the spatial coordinates, whatever system you happen to be using. And so the order is the highest power of the derivatives, and that's two because of the two space derivatives. It is linear in the function. The function is the wave function psi. So here I have the second spatial derivatives of the wave function, but that whole term in the blue box raised to the first power. Here I have the zeroth derivative, which is just the function itself, again raised to the first power. And here I have a time derivative of the function, but again raised to the first power. So it is in fact linear in the function. And it's homogeneous because every term involves either psi or its derivative. So there's a psi, there's a psi, there's a psi. There's no term that doesn't have a psi in it. So this equation is homogeneous. If you were inclined to use Cartesian coordinates, then the wave function would depend on x, y, z, and t. And in order to use the separation of variables technique, I would make the ansatz that this can be written in a factorized form. So it would be some function of x times some function of y, times some function of z, times a fourth function of time, t. And the idea is, if this ansatz is correct, you should be able to plug your guess for the wave function into the differential equation. So plug it into these three terms above, and then what will result would be four ordinary differential equations, four ODEs, instead of one partial differential equation, which depends on four variables. You're going to wind up with four ordinary differential equations, each of which only depends on one coordinate. So you get one ODE in X, one ODE in Y, one ODE in Z, and another ODE in time. Here is another equation that is ubiquitous in physics. This is the wave equation. There's our Laplacian scalar operator again, second order differential operator. Laplacian acting on some function of the three spatial coordinates and time again is minus one over some velocity. This is the wave speed. If you're talking about light waves in vacuum, then c is the speed of light, but this could describe waves in any medium, any kind of wave, sound waves in air, for example. And then c would be the speed of sound in air. And then there's a term that looks like the second derivative with respect to time of the function again, and let's characterize it. For practice, it is second order both in the spatial derivatives and in the time derivatives, so it's definitely a second order differential equation. The function is u, and it is linear in u, so I have two spatial derivatives, but to the first power, and over here, two time derivatives, but raised to the first power, so it's linear in u, and it's homogeneous. Every term has a u in it. There's no term that does not have the u. by the way, just to explain the notation a little bit, in the last lecture, when we talked about the Laplacian, I told you there was this notation where instead of writing the Laplacian as the nabla symbol squared, some textbooks write it as an upside down nabla as a delta. And I told you that that's a little dangerous because it looks like delta t, it looks like the change in t. But someone decided, well, if you're taking space derivatives and you have three coordinates, that's a triangle. And if you're going to take three space derivatives and one time derivative, then maybe that should be a square. So physicists sometimes have a little bit of whimsy and they like to have a little fun. This square operator acting on the function is called the D'Alembertian. So it's this combination. It's the Laplacian minus one over some wave speed square times the second time derivative. That's all encoded in that that X symbol. Later on, when you learn relativistic notation, including the Einstein summation convention, this same operator, which is written up, above here as well, the same operator is written as d upper mu, d lower mu. And when you see one raised index and one lower index, you're supposed to sum. So that out in front, there is a missing summation symbol, sigma, as mu goes from 0 to 3. 0 is the time direction, and then 1 is x, 2 is y, and 3 would be z. They all mean the same thing. So if you see any of these forms, they all refer to the D'Alembertian or the wave equation operator. Another differential equation that involves this now familiar Laplacian is the Helmholtz equation. So this says the Laplacian acting on some function of spatial coordinates A plus k squared, k is some constant, times A is equal to 0. Again, this is second order because of the two spatial derivatives. It is linear in the function. The function is A. So here is Laplacian of A, but to the first power, and here's the zeroth derivative A itself, but to the first power. So linear in A, and homogeneous, every term involves an A. There are no terms without an A. These two equations, the previous one, the wave equation, and the Helmholtz equation, are related to each other. The Helmholtz equation is what results if you take the Fourier transform of the wave equation with respect to time. So this is a look back in the notes when we talked about Fourier transform. If you take the Fourier transform, the conjugate variable to the time is the angular frequency omega. And so taking two time derivatives is like bringing down two factors of omega. So under Fourier transform, this one in the numerator would become omega squared. And if omega is the angular frequency and c is the speed of light, then omega squared over c squared is the wave number k squared. So these two are related through the Fourier time transform. And another equation that involves the Laplacian operator is the heat equation. The heat equation says that the time derivative of u, this is a different, I'm using the same symbol u of r and t as above, but it has a different meaning. Down here, u is the temperature. In the heat equation, u is the temperature. So this is the temperature at three spatial coordinates and then some time. If you're in Cartesian coordinates, the temperature at some x, y, z, t. And this says the time derivative of the temperature minus 1 over k. The k also has a different meaning. That in the Helmholtz equation, the k is the wave number. Down here, k is the thermal conductivity. K times, and then if you're in three dimensions, this derivative is the Laplacian operator acting on the temperature again. I guess people call the temperature u, because if you called it t, you'd get confused between the temperature t and the time variable t. But anyway, historically, people call the temperature u. This is also related to one of the equations above. If you look at the Schrodinger equation on the top of the page, if you set the potential in the Schrodinger equation to 0 to knock out this middle term, you would get a time derivative. Well, that looks like the time derivative in the heat equation. And then I have the Laplacian acting on the function. And so over here, the Laplacian acting on the function. One difference is that in the Schrodinger equation, the time derivative comes with this imaginary unit I, the square root of -1. whereas in the heat equation, that's real. And these two equations are related by what's called the wick rotation, W-I-C-K, wick rotation. That's where you let this time become imaginary. So send this t to it. Take this time variable and let it become, and then the imaginary unit I times the time variable, and the heat equation will result. So if you can solve the Schrodinger equation, you can solve the heat equation, and vice versa. They're really the same thing. All right, now I'd like to show you how to solve, I have to pick one of these six. So let's take the Laplace equation. I'm gonna show you first how to solve the Laplace equation in one dimension where it's absolutely trivial, and then show you how much more complicated it gets when you go from one dimension to two dimensions. But there's a silver lining, and that is to go from two dimensions to three or four or any large number of dimensions is really easy. So the hard part is going from one dimension to two, but then three looks just like two and four looks just like three. All right, so let's see how this works. Let's take an example where the potential, the voltage, phi, only depends on the z-coordinate and not x and not y. Okay, so for this last term, just replace this by phi of z, and then you won't have the second derivative with respect to x or the second derivative with respect to y. You will only have the second derivative with respect to z, and you can change that partial into a full derivative. So it would say second derivative with respect to z of the voltage function of z is equal to zero. Let's see how you would solve that. Well, if two derivatives of the function is equal to zero, you can integrate that once and get a constant, and then you can integrate that again and get a constant times z plus another constant. And so the most general solution to Laplace's equation in one dimension is really simple. It's a straight line. It's some constant that you can call C1 times Z plus another constant C2, or if you want to make it look more familiar to you from high school algebra, you can write it as MZ plus B, where M is the slope of the line and B is the vertical intercept. Well, here's an example. Suppose that at z equals a, where a is 1 meter, the voltage happens to be 4 volts. And at z equals b, where b is 3 meters, the voltage happens to be 7 volts. So those are the boundary conditions. The voltage at 1 meter and the voltage at 3 meters are boundary conditions. What is the voltage in between? And this equation is telling you just connect the points by a straight line, and that will give you the voltage at any point in between a and b. So this is just easy algebra. The slope m is the rise over the run. The rise is 7 volts minus 4 volts or plus 3 volts. The run is 3 meters minus 1 meter or 2 meters. So the rise over run is 3/2 of a volt per meter. And if you plug in m, plug in the slope into this equation and solve for the intercept, at one of these two points, you can use the lower point or the upper point, it doesn't matter which one, you'll get the same answer in both cases. You'll find that the vertical intercept B is 3/2. And so the voltage function of Z is 3/2 Z plus 5/2 for this problem, this one-dimensional problem with given boundary conditions. And that's it, that's the complete solution. We did it in a few lines and in less than a minute. All right, now we're gonna look at a two-dimensional problem, and you'll see how much more complicated it gets very quickly. All right, here's an example of a problem that depends on two coordinates. So here I have the x coordinate plotted to the right as usual, the y coordinate plotted vertically up, and in a right-handed system, the z coordinate would be coming out of the page toward you. This circle with a dot in it is the notation for a vector coming out toward your eye. And an example of a problem that depends only on x and y, but not z, would be the following. Suppose you have two semi-infinite planes and then joined by an infinite strip. So if that's hard to see in the left diagram, look over here. This vertical a line right here is this axis, it's the y-axis, but that's, it's not really a line, it's a whole plane. So you have to imagine this going into the screen and coming out of the screen infinite in both directions, so infinite along the z-direction. And in the same way, this line over here is really a plane seen in cross-section, that's this plane, at x equals a, and again, semi-infinite, so it goes from y equals zero and the bottom all the way up to y equals infinity, but it also goes into and out of the screen infinite in both directions. So two semi-infinite planes, and then this thing on the bottom, which again looks like a line in cross-section, is really this rectangular strip. And so it's finite in the x direction from x equals zero to x equals a, but it's infinite in the z direction. Again, the strip goes all the way into the screen to z equals minus infinity and comes out of the screen all the way to z equals plus infinity. So the whole idea is, because this this channel, this rectangular channel, I guess you could call it a rain gutter, is infinite in the z direction, you can't tell where you are. If you're sitting at z equals zero, it looks like the cross-section drawn here. But if you moved to z equals 1 meter, the cross-section would look the same. If you move to z equals 1 light year away, it would look the same. You can't tell where you are in the z direction. So the fancy way of saying that is that this problem has translational invariance in the z direction. And therefore, because the boundary conditions don't depend on z, the boundary conditions can only depend on two coordinates, x and y, the solution inside the channel, the voltage inside the channel, which is what you're looking for, that can only depend on x and y as well. So this is a two-dimensional problem. And we will solve Laplace's equation in two dimensions for the voltage inside the channel. So I will tell you the boundary conditions, I'll tell you the voltage on these three surfaces, and then your job will be to find the voltage in the middle where the green hatch marks are. Okay, there are going to be four boundary conditions. Imagine that these plates are made of metal, these two semi-infinite plates of the rain gutter, the one at x equals zero and the one at x equals a. Imagine they're made of metal, and I will connect them to ground. To remind you of your 1304 course, this is the symbol for voltage equals zero. So I will connect this metal plate to ground, and therefore the voltage will be zero everywhere on the back plate. And I will also ground the plate at x equals a. So this plate as well, the front plate will be grounded, set equal to zero voltage. And then on the bottom strip, I will put some voltage of my choosing. So think of V naught of x as arbitrary. That's one of the boundary conditions. And I said there are four, so the fourth one is over here. As you let y go all the way to infinity, way up past the top of the page, the voltage should also go to zero in the limit. So as y approaches zero, the voltage should asymptotically approach zero as well. Okay, that's our problem. So it's a two-dimensional problem. You can forget about the z-direction, just suppress the z-axis, look in the xy plane, and given these four boundary conditions in red, solve for the voltage as a function of x and y everywhere inside the channel. That's the task. All right, we'll make our ansatz for separation of variables. We'll say that this voltage function of x and y inside the channel is some function of x multiplied by some function of y, so it will factorize. That trick happens to work in this problem, which is why I'm showing you this problem as an illustration. And if I write down the Laplacian operator in two dimensions, x and y, it will look like this. The Laplacian is second partial derivative with respect to x plus the second partial derivative with respect to y. These expressions don't make any sense until you put something on the right-hand side. And so both of these partial derivative operators are going to act on the voltage function phi of x and y. And in factorized form, that's written like this, f of x times g of y. And the right-hand side of this homogeneous equation is zero. So the right-hand side is equal to zero. Okay, when you carry out these differentiations, you have to use the product rule on the product of f of x and g of y. But when the x derivative when the partial derivative with respect to x acts on this pair of functions, it only acts on the f of x, because when you take the partial derivative, you're supposed to treat the other variable as if it were a constant. And if y is a constant, then g of y is a constant. And then furthermore, the partial derivative with respect to x acting on a function of x alone, you can write as a full derivative instead of a partial derivative. So I have full derivative squared with respect to x acting on the function f of x, and then simply times g of y. So that's the first term. In the second term, everything is reversed. When the differential operator partial derivative squared with respect to y squared acts on the pair of functions f of y, you treat f of x like a constant, and the derivative will act only on g of y, but then a partial derivative with respect to y acting on a function of y is a full derivative with respect to y. So you get f of x untouched, and then full derivative d squared g with respect to y squared. And the right-hand side is still equal to zero, so I copy that down here. And now the trick is to divide this entire equation. There are three terms. There are two terms on the left and a zero term on the right-hand side. Divide all three terms of this equation by the product of f times g, which in fact is the function psi itself. So divide all three terms by psi. Well, the right-hand side is easy. Zero divided by psi is zero. And then over here, when I divide this term by f times g, the g's will cancel. And in the numerator, you'll get the second derivative of f of x with respect to x squared, and then in the denominator, just f of x. In the second term, when I divide this by f times g, the f will cancel in the numerator and the denominator, and you'll wind up getting second derivative of g with respect to y squared, and then divided by g of y in the denominator. Now, there's a subtlety here, because you've been told all your life not to divide by zero. That's a no-no in mathematics. But there are points inside the channel where it might be that the voltage function happens to vanish. Here's an example. The voltage might vanish at that point. So there are x's and y's at which f of x could be zero, and g of y could be zero, and yet you're dividing by them, you have them in the denominator. Isn't that going to cause any trouble? And the answer is no. It's correct to be concerned about it, but that won't hurt anything, because if the function f of x vanishes, it will vanish at an isolated point. That is, it might vanish at x equals 2, but it won't be zero at x equals 2.001. It won't vanish at x equals 1.999. It will just vanish at one isolated point among a non-denumerable infinity of other points. So the mathematicians have a way to describe this. They say that the Lebesgue measure of that one point is equal to zero. So you can actually divide by zero if it's one isolated point in the middle of an uncountable infinity of other points where f of x is not zero. So that it sounds a little strange, but that it makes it puts the theory on a solid footing. It is okay to do that. Okay, the point is, though, here I have a fraction. So I have the second derivative of f with respect to its argument x squared in the numerator divided by f of x in the denominator. Both terms, the numerator and the denominator of this expression, only depend on x, and so the whole fraction only depends on x. So I'll call that another function. I'll say h of x. And then similarly, here I have second partial of g of y with respect to y squared. That's some other function of y in the numerator. And then in the denominator, I have g of y itself, and so this entire fraction only depends on y, and I called it by some other name. It's some function j of y. But this function h of x plus this function j of y have to sum to zero for any x and any y that I pick. And a little bit of thought will tell you the only way that can happen is if h of x is some constant and j of y is the negative of that same constant. there cannot be, in other words, there can't be any x dependence in the h of x, and there can't be any y dependence in the j of y, because if there were, you could pick a different x and a different y, and then you'd spoil the cancellation. They would no longer sum to zero. So both of these functions, in fact, have to be constants. This constant I will call alpha squared, because it's going to be real and positive. And writing it as alpha squared will save a lot of trouble on the next page, you'll see. Otherwise, I could just call this constant in the box something like C. But then further on in the notes, I would have to take the square root of C all the time. And so because I know that's coming up, I will call this constant alpha squared. This constant is called the separation constant. The constant that results from using the separation of variables technique is called the separation constant. So one of these terms is plus alpha squared, and the other term is minus alpha squared, and when you add them together, you get zero. Now, there's a choice here. I could make the h of x positive alpha squared and make the j of y negative alpha squared. So how do you know which separation constant to make positive and which to make negative? Let's hold off on that question for just a little bit, and I'll come back to it and tell you how you tell which one is which. Okay. Well, one differential equation is this. Second partial with respect to x squared of f of x divided by f of x equals minus alpha squared. So that equation is written here. And I've cleaned it up and I put it in standard form. So in standard form, it looks like this. Second derivative of f of x with respect to x squared plus alpha squared times f of x is equal to zero. And now this should be very familiar to it. It should look like an old friend. This is in fact the harmonic oscillator, undamped harmonic oscillator equation. And the solutions are either sines and cosines, or they are complex exponentials, e to the I alpha x and e to the minus I alpha x, or you can write it as some constant times sine plus a phase, or some other constant times the cosine plus a phase. All right, any of those four terms are all equivalent. We had a homework assignment on that. I will pick the sine and cosine form. So some constant, which will be fixed by initial conditions, times the sine of alpha x plus another constant, because this equation, after all, is second order, right? There are two derivatives. And so in a second order equation, you get two arbitrary constants. And so the other one is C2, and that gets multiplied by the second solution, cosine of alpha x. In the harmonic oscillator, this term was written as omega squared. So now it's alpha squared. Okay, these two functions, sine and cosine, for different frequencies, alpha, are complete. And remember what that means. Way back early in the course, we talked about completeness. That means you can take any function whatsoever and you can expand it in sines and cosines. That's Fourier analysis. That's what happens when you make a Fourier series. You take a given function and you expand it in sines and cosines. Okay, now let's take the other equation that was written up here. Two derivatives of g of y with respect to y squared divided by g of y is equal to plus alpha squared. And that's copied here in green. And then below it, I put it in standard form. So two derivatives of g with respect to y squared minus alpha squared g of y is equal to zero. The solutions to this equation in green are growing and decaying exponentials. Again, it's second order, so I should expect two arbitrary constants of integration. I call them d1 and d2 to go along with c1 and c2. And so one solution is e to the minus alpha y. That's the decaying solution. So multiply that by d1. And then the other solution is the growth, e to the plus alpha y, and I multiply that by d2. There is a way to write these growing and decaying exponentials in terms of other functions, much like we did above when we wrote sine and cosine these three different ways. In the same way, you can write growing and decaying exponentials in terms of these hyperbolic functions. So you could have written, instead of writing d1 e to the minus alpha y plus d2 e to the plus alpha y, you could have written d3 sinh of alpha y plus d4 cosh alpha y. And d3 and d4 are related to d1 and d2. here's a quick sketch. This is what the hyperbolic cosine looks like. Because of my poor drawing skills, it looks like a parabola, but it's not parabolic. All right, so this is the Cauchy function, and the important thing is that the Cauchy function is never zero. The lowest it ever gets is one at the origin. When you plug in y equals zero, e to the zero is one, e to the minus zero is also one. One plus one is two, two over two is one. So that point right there is at one. It never gets any lower than that. The sinh function is by the way, the Cauchy function is even. The sinh function is odd, and this does go through the origin like every odd function does, but it only goes through the y-axis once. It's only zero in one place. Sinh and Cauchy are not complete. That is, you cannot take any given function of y and expand it in hyperbolic sines and cosines. Okay, now we can go back and answer the question, how do you know which separation constant to make positive and which to make negative? And we have to go back to the picture. Down here on the bottom of the channel, along this strip, this rectangle on the bottom of the rain gutter, I'm going to impose some arbitrary function v naught of x. And so I need to have the ability to expand that function v naught of x in some functions that are complete. So I want the functions in x to be complete so that I can expand v naught of x in them. And therefore, I need to get sines and cosines in x because those functions are complete. So I need the sines and cosines to make up the v naught of x. And so I had to choose the separation constant for x to be negative in order to get sine and cosine solutions here. But once you choose the separation constant for x to be negative alpha squared, you are forced to have the separation constant for y to be positive alpha squared, right? One has to be negative, one has to be positive. And for a positive separation constant, you get growing and decaying exponentials, or you get sinhs and cosines, which are not complete. But that's okay. I don't need the functions in y to be complete, but I definitely need the functions in x to be complete so I can make up this boundary condition on the bottom. Okay, so that's how you know how to pick the sine of the separation constant. All right, let's go a little further. Now I'm going to start imposing the four boundary conditions. So we'll take our solution for f of x so far. Remember, it's c1 sine of alpha x plus c2 cosine of alpha x. And I'll begin to plug in the boundary conditions. Well, the first boundary condition will be over here. When x is equal to zero, that infinite plate is grounded. So that means the voltage has to be zero there. And that means f of x has to be zero. So the boundary condition at x equals zero and any y whatsoever is equal to zero. And the only way to make that happen is if f evaluated at zero is equal to zero. Okay, so take the f of x function and plug in zero. So instead of sine of alpha x, you get sine of alpha times zero. Instead of cosine of alpha x, cosine times alpha zero, cosine rather of alpha zero. And the whole thing on the left-hand side at the f of zero is equal to zero. So zero is equal to c1 sine of zero, but sine of zero is nothing. So sine of zero knocks out this entire first term. However, cosine of zero is one. And so what remains is C2. And if you look back, you have F of zero, which is nothing, is equal to C2. So this equation is telling you that the coefficient of the cosine is equal to zero. C2 is equal to zero. So we solved for one of the arbitrary constants using one of the initial conditions or one of the boundary conditions. All right, so we found out C2 is equal to zero. Let's try it again. And this time we'll look at x equals a. So we'll look at this plane here. This is also grounded. So when x is equal to a and y is equal to anything, the voltage should be zero. And that means here, the voltage for x equals a and y equals anything has to be zero. That means that this function f evaluated at a has to be zero. Well, we already got rid of the C2, so f of x is now C1 sine of alpha x. And if I plug in x equals a, I get f of a is equal to c1 sine of alpha a equals 0. Well, here I have the product of two terms. I have c1 multiplied by sine of alpha a. That product has to be 0. So one or the other or both of these things can be 0. But you don't want to choose c1 to be 0. Why not? Because up above, we already found that c2 is definitely 0. And if you make c1 0 as well, then the whole function f of x is 0 everywhere. And that is not the right answer. That tells you that there's no voltage, that the voltage is 0 everywhere in the channel, right here, right? The voltage for any x and any y in the channel is equal to 0. And that will not satisfy the boundary condition at the bottom. If you press the solution all the way down to the x-axis, you will not recover this voltage function V naught of x that we put on the bottom rectangle, the bottom part of the channel. So that's wrong. It can't be that C1 is equal to 0. Therefore, it must be that sine of alpha A is equal to 0. And that will be true if the argument of the sine, alpha A, is equal to some integer times pi. So alpha A equals n pi, where n is non-zero. N is some positive integer, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to infinity. The jargon is to say that this separation constant alpha is quantized. That is, alpha can't just be any old real number. Alpha has to be some integer number n, positive integer, times pi divided by the width of the channel A. And if you've seen this in your modern physics course or your quantum mechanics course, exactly the same thing happens because the Schrodinger equation also involves the Laplacian operator. So you also get quantized variables, quantum numbers. Okay, well, good. So now we solved for the separation constant. It's n pi over a, where n is a positive integer. And that same separation constant that we got from the blue equation in x, the f of x equation, that same separation constant occurs in the y equation in green. So the x and y solutions talk to each other through the separation constant. Right? Here's the x equation with an alpha in it. Here's the y equation also with the same alpha in it, with granted with a different sign, but it's the same separation constant alpha. So my g of y function is in growth and decay form. It's d1 e to the minus alpha y plus d2 e to the plus alpha y. But now I know what alpha is. I can substitute up here. And so the solutions are d1 e to the minus n pi y over a plus d2 e to the plus n pi y over a. Now we scroll back up to the picture, and I'm going to impose this boundary condition on the top. Remember, we already took care of this one. We took care of the left boundary condition at x equals a. That told us that c2 is equal to 0. We took care of the boundary condition at x equals a. That told us that the separation constant alpha was quantized. Now we're going to look at this one. In the limit, as y goes to infinity, I want the voltage to asymptotically approach 0. So I look back at my g of y equation in green here. This first solution decays as y goes to infinity. That's okay. This one blows up. So in order to get g of y equal to 0 as y goes to infinity, I have to throw away this constant d2. So I use the top boundary condition to say that d2 is equal to 0. All right, now where are we? Well, I know f of x is this. F of x is c1 sine of alpha x, and I know what the separation constant alpha is. And now I know that g of y is d1 e to the minus alpha y. And again, I know what alpha is. So if I plug all that in, the solution inside the channel, the voltage at any x and any y inside the channel, by my ansatz, should be f of x times g of y. And this first form is the f of x function, c1 sine of alpha x, and alpha is n pi over a, so all that times x, times g of y, and g of y is written over here, it's d1 e to the minus n pi y over a. Okay, now I have the product of two constants. C1 is a constant and D1 is a constant. Well, the product of two constants is a constant. It's not two constants, it's one constant. So I called the product of C1 and D1, I called it A. And then you realize, because this n can be anything, n can be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way to infinity, I'm going to get a solution for every possible n. And so I indexed the coefficient out in front. Instead of calling them a, b, c, d, because I'll run out of letters before I get to infinity, I called it a sub n. So there's an a1 to go along when n is equal to 1 in both of the other terms, and then there's an a2 to go along when n is equal to 2, and so forth. And the general solution is the sum of all those together. So again, to summarize, we have the voltage written everywhere inside the channel for any x between 0 and a, and any y between 0 and infinity. The voltage is a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, some constants that we still have to work out. I haven't told you what the a sub n's are, but we'll get to that in just a second, times the sine of n pi x over a, times a decaying exponential e to the minus n pi y over a. Okay, how do we solve for these coefficients a sub n? Well, there's one more boundary condition to impose. So let's scroll back up to the picture. The boundary condition that we have not yet imposed is the bottom one. When y is equal to 0 and x is trapped between 0 and a, the voltage should be this arbitrary function of my choice, v naught of x. So you'd be given this. If I gave you an exam problem, I would specify what the v naught of x was on the bottom. And then the problem is, how do you pick the a sub n's to make that true? Well, the bottom of the channel is at y equals 0. So take this solution and plug in right here, plug in y equals 0. Well, the only place the y occurs is up in the exponent here. And if you set y equal to 0, this becomes e to the 0. E to the 0 is 1. So on the bottom of the channel, the voltage for any x between 0 and a, but y set equal to 0, should be v naught of x. But v naught of x is this sum with y set equal to 0, and that's the sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, a sub n sine of n pi x over a. Okay, now bells should be going off in your head. This should look extremely familiar. This is what we did when we studied Fourier series. And so what you're going to do is Fourier decompose this function that I give you, this v naught of x, and you're going to find its odd Fourier series coefficients a sub n, just like you did on a previous homework assignment. So for example, if I gave you this function in red for v naught of x, if I gave you this whole function in red, from x equals 0 to x equals a, this function happens to have a jump discontinuity in it. That's okay. All right, so everything in the box is the v naught of x for the actual problem. So what you're supposed to do is make an odd extension. So you know what to do. You reflect this red function through the origin, and you make it odd. And then you take this function from minus a to plus a, and you cut and paste, and you extend it infinitely in the positive x direction and infinitely in the minus x direction. And now the function is both odd and periodic, and so you're able to expand it in sines. And then it's just a matter of looking back in your notes and figuring out how to get the Fourier coefficients a sub n. For example, on the final exam, I could give you the following problem. I could give you this two-dimensional separation of variables problem, and for the voltage on the bottom, the v naught of x, I could give you something like this. So change this right extent, instead of L, call that A, and then it will match the problem that we're doing. This voltage is 0 from x equals a to x equals a over 4, and it's 0 from x equals 3/4 a to a. So the first quarter is has voltage equal to 0, the last quarter has voltage equal to 0, and the two middle quarters, the middle half of the interval, could be some voltage like 100 volts, for example. So that's a perfectly reasonable problem that you might see on a test. Okay, that's separation of variables technique. Hope that made sense.